Welcome to the Share Life podcast with Jason Scott Montoya, where we explore stories and systems to live better and work smarter. Another inspirational episode of the Share Life podcast. I'm Jason Scott Montoya, and today I'm here with Ellen Bristol. Ellen, say hello.
Hi, everybody.
Ellen is the founder of the Bristol Strategy Group. She helps nonprofits to fundraise, figure out why their fundraising isn't working, and create systems and also coaching and guidance to help them. She's also got some pretty phenomenal software that helps streamline the entire process. So we're going to dive into Ellen's story. She's going to tell us a little about what she knows, who she is, where she comes from. So Ellen, I'll let you take it from here.
Oh my goodness. Where do I start? Well, back at the dawn of time.
I mean, you're only 27, right?
Yeah, right. And this is one of the things Jason and I agreed I would talk about. I was actually born on as the U.S. troops were landing on Normandy Beach, which was turning point of a point of World War II. I was born late at night on June 5th, 1944. And it was already June 6th in Europe.
Oh, wow.
And the landing was already going on. So I was a little confused most of my life. What, the entire world is celebrating?
Were you ever old enough to know? I mean, when the war ended, were you even old enough to know what was going on?
I was an infant. But the funny thing is, your kids are going to remember 9/11, even if they weren't born yet.
It's kind of like an inherited memory.
Well, what I think about is that I still think somewhere in the back of my mind that World War II was my war. And the reason I think that way, although really the war in Vietnam was much more likely my war. But I believe I think that way because, it was the constant dialogue in my parents' generation among all of my aunts and uncles and cousins and friends and so on. And our family is Jewish, although we had all my ancestors had all left the old country around the turn of the 20th century. So we had no relatives back in Eastern Europe at the time.
What parts of Eastern Europe?
Right now, my paternal grandparents, I don't know what country it was then, but it's Moldova today.
Oh, okay. Oh, wow.
Yeah. They disembarked from Odessa, which is Ukraine.
Yeah. Wow.
So,
I mean, do you have any, with everything going on with Russia and Ukraine right now, is any of your family affected, just your relatives, or is that?
Not really, because it's not like, I have friends all over the country who can trace their heritage back many generations. We can't. Past has been snipped off because my grandparents were all young adults or children when they came over here, and they all wanted to forget the old country. So that had some kind of effect on me, which maybe I'll figure out in the 22nd century. Jason and I first got to know each other about a dozen years ago, or when I started to really concentrate on the nonprofit sector. For years before that, I worked in corporate sales. I used to sell standalone word processing systems. They predate the personal computer by quite a few years.
So was that in the 80s?
Yeah, actually, that was in the late 70s.
Oh, okay. Wow.
So I've been around technology now for a very long time. So when I finally left the word processing world, I went to work in sales selling mainframe computers, which were zillion-dollar machines, the big, you know, if you see movies from the 80s.
Yeah.
That's what you see. And they were zillion-dollar investments with water-cooled rooms and all this special nonsense. And, of course, they had less power than this thing that we all are glued to all the time, our cell phones, our mobile phones. And I was living in Manhattan, New York City for many, many years. I grew up in New Jersey, and I always thought, oh boy, I'll really be a grown-up and I'll really be cool if I go and live in New York City. Right?
Like Manhattan, probably, right?
Yeah, right.
Yeah, yeah.
And I can tell you the cool factor started to wear out at a certain point. And I made the decision to move to Florida.
Before it was cool?
It was just starting to get cool. Okay. And South Beach was in the process of being rediscovered. It was 1986 when I moved down here.
I was only two at the time.
And I'd been married before, but I had been single for a very long time. I met my husband here. And I worked in my last corporate job the first 9 years after I moved to Miami. And in 1995, I was working for one of the major corporations, and we went through 9 consecutive quarters of layoffs. And every corporate layoff, they said, oh, we'll never do that again. And then 9 years later, poof.
Was that anxiety-inducing for you?
Oh, it was horrible.
Yeah.
It was horrible.
It's like a traumatic experience, yeah.
Well, everybody was spending most of their time on the phone bribing officials
to get laid off
the next time. I'm exaggerating. But you really couldn't think about anything. And it's not a good position to be in if you're trying to sell something. People say, wouldn't touch you with a 10-foot pole, right? And I took a little course on running your own business. I should mention that my father and his two brothers and most of the relatives I have on my mother's side of the family are entrepreneurs.
Yeah.
So it's kind of in my blood. And I was getting tired of being managed by men who were both younger and less well educated than I and who didn't know what they were doing. And so I mentioned to my husband I was taking this class, and he said, what's taking you so long? I've been waiting for you to do this. So I launched Bristol.
So you were really one of the early feminists then, right?
Well, yeah. Actually, I was in the second wave.
Yeah.
Betty Friedan and who wrote the feminine. Yeah, I think she wrote The Feminine Mystique, and Gloria Steinem are both a generation ahead of me.
Yeah.
Right. But at the time, there were a lot of women going into sales because they were so hungry. The IT firms, information technology firms, were so hungry for sales talent. They didn't care.
Oh, wow.
About gender or race or any of that. So like, can you speak?
We'll hire you.
Paragraphs, you know, we'll hire
you. Yeah, that's awesome.
And it was great training. I got to tell you, I think having sales experience is one of the best things anybody could do if they want to have a business career. You don't have to be a sales professional your whole life.
Yeah.
But you kind of really need to know how money flows through an organization and what it makes possible and what it doesn't make possible.
Yeah.
Right? The pitch here is not everybody should be in sales so they can make a lot of money. That's not the point.
Yeah.
The point is getting over your own ickiness or wackiness about selling or asking for money or any of that. So anyway, I'm happily running along, developing approaches to consulting, and I was working in working with sales organizations, and I kind of started to realize how much I loved it.
Yeah, like the coaching aspect of it, or
it was the coaching aspect of it, and it was the part of demystifying it, of saying, look, if you're going to sell business to business, and you're going to sell like I did, where millions of dollars was at stake, you kind of have to have your act together. You have to be able to do some things that are going to sound a little bit harsh. You have to be able to explain what the return is going to be on the buyer's investment. You have to be able to explain what the cost of owning and operating this stuff is going to be.
Yeah.
And you have to start to have three brains in your head at the same time. What am I trying to accomplish? What are they trying to accomplish? And how can I keep them from throwing me out the door? Which, if you want to put it in kinder terms, means how do I establish rapport with these folks so that they don't think I'm just there to flog them to buy something? And if you can master that, you can be very comfortable in a sales role because you don't mind when they say no.
Yeah. Rejection, right? What's going on there in that rejection? Why do people struggle with that?
I don't know. I think I actually think this is a great question because I think there are two pieces to it. One is when people who don't know how to sell think about selling, they think it's, hello, give me your money right now. Buy from me or I'll kill you. When what it is really is a lot like making a friendship. Nice to meet you. Here's what I do. I have this suspicion that what I do might offer some benefit to what you do. Let's talk about it. Tell me about yourself. What's going on? Those are the two best openers, by the way. Tell me about yourself. Right? And I learned by making 10 zillion idiotic mistakes. Don't start out saying, here's my catalog of wonderful things that cost a gazillion dollars. I start out by saying, tell me about yourself. So you remember you were more than 2 years old. The Great Recession of 2008 and 2009, the housing bubble and all that. All of my clients fired me. And then my husband developed a very serious health problem that required extensive surgery. And he was falling apart. I was falling apart. There was no money coming in. It was like, and I worked too hard all the time anyway. And I discovered I didn't have a choice. I had to chill out. Well, I called a colleague of mine who had been running a reasonably successful coaching business. And I said, I'll teach your team how to sell if you'll be my business coach. And it was a great decision. And I said, well, there must be a reason somebody invented credit cards. So we sort of didn't worry. And then I looked back and I was like, what were we thinking?
Desperate measures.
Desperate times call for desperate measures. And one of the things that occurred to me with the help of my coaches was, what do you really love to do? What do you really love to work on? Well, I already knew I loved to work with people who wanted to improve their ability to sell.
Yeah.
But I really loved working with people in the nonprofit sector. And I'll tell you why. My first clue was if I made a phone call and asked for a meeting when I was selling mainframe technology, people would say, yeah, a salesperson, click. And when I would call to set up a meeting with somebody in the nonprofit sector, they would say, you want to help us? That's wonderful. When can you be here? And I thought, oh, that's kind of nice, you know? So I'm making this very short. What I realized was that I brought a lot of great selling strategy, philosophy, and disciplines with me.
Yeah.
And I looked at what was going on in the nonprofit sector and I said, you know, no wonder these guys are struggling. They tend not to have some of the basic business disciplines that high performing corporate sales teams have. And there's no reason I couldn't repurpose those disciplines and make them feel culturally appropriate for nonprofits.
Yeah. And recontextualize them.
Yeah. And I've been very successful.
Why was it that the nonprofit world had neglected it so badly?
I can't take credit for this. A guy named Dan Pallotta has done a lot of research on this. And now I can't remember the name of his book. But
well, we'll put a link in the notes. Yeah.
Yeah, he gave a TED talk that really revolutionized things. And he said, you know, philanthropy as we know it kind of arose in 18th and 19th century Europe, especially in England. And the sort of avatar of the philanthropic person was a wealthy aristocrat who would go and impoverish themselves, bringing culture, Eurocentric culture, for the poor and downtrodden natives, usually of a different skin color. And they unconsciously measured their impact by how impoverished or ill they, the donors, became as a result of being kind to the mm-hmm. poor and downtrodden. And when you describe it like that, it's disgusting. But I think it's left, some of that has left an unfortunate legacy that makes a lot of folks in the nonprofit sector believe that trying to bring in adequate financial resources is somehow it's not charitable. It's like you're not supposed to have decent furniture or pay your employees a living wage. And there's been ongoing controversy about that.
Yeah.
You know, home health care aides, for example, do very difficult physical and emotional work.
Yeah.
And a lot of them are being paid
poorly
at such low rates that they're also on public assistance.
Mm.
While the senior leadership in the team are making six figures.
It's
depressing. So I said, you know, guys, it's not just knowing how to go and ask for money. It's not just knowing who's got a lot of money. It's more like having some disciplines in place that reduce your anxiety about asking for money. Instead of saying, I'm here to ask you for money, why not say, why are you a charitable person? What kind of life experiences have you had? Is being philanthropic, does that come from your personal experience? Do you have a family or a faith tradition that honors it? Tell me about yourself. And so we've had, up to this point, when the business is finally starting to grow and add people and do stuff, we've had a big impact. And I'm extremely proud of it.
Yeah. Yeah, that's awesome. So how long has Bristol Strategy existed as a company?
It's about 28 years old.
Okay. So sometime in the mid-90s.
So January 2025 will be 30 years.
Ah, so 1995. Okay.
Yeah, exactly.
Wow, 25 years. So there's not very many companies that make it that long, you know?
Well, I guess I was just too bullheaded and stubborn to give up. I mean, for one thing, Jason, even the years that we just barely made enough to scrape by, I was called to this work. I enjoy it thoroughly. The personal satisfaction I get out of it means more to me than the money, although money's not terrible to have, you know. And now that I'm, you know, in my later years, we're a little more concerned about what a friend of mine calls the decrepitude fund.
So how have you stayed so young then?
I think I was a much unhappier person when I was young.
Oh, okay.
And as the decades have piled up, it's like something blossomed in me. The year that I started this business, I started the business the year I turned 50. Mm-hmm. And every decade since then has been like, how can it be even cooler than it was last year? So for me, if it's not joyful, it would really be better off if you didn't have to do it.
Yeah.
I mean, actually hearing myself say that makes me want to barf a little bit because it sounds like, oh, white privilege. But don't you think everybody ought to have a chance to enjoy what they're doing?
Yeah, I mean, Simon Sinek, I don't know if you're familiar with Simon Sinek, but he talks a lot about that as well. Like, he kind of pushes it like to the, like, you have the right to have that. And I think, there are times when, like, we have to do something we don't want to do out of duty. Right. But I think we should be moving towards that, and we shouldn't be trapped in something that is destroying us on the inside, right?
That's the point. Yeah.
So I definitely can relate to that. So I'm going to be 39 in October.
Baby.
Rewind a few of those decades. What would you tell your 39-year-old self?
I would tell my 39-year-old self, hang on. You actually know you have the grit and determination to make it better. 39 was a very bad time in my life. Details are being withheld.
That'll be in the R-rated version later released.
But those, you know, until I was in my early 40s, things were not great. And I knew somewhere deep down inside that I was betting on the right horse, if we want to use that analogy.
In terms of the work you were doing?
In terms, not so much of the work that I was doing, but the context in which I was doing that work.
Got it.
I was betting on the right horse, me, but I had that horse in the wrong race. If I could look back to when I was 39 and I could say, you know, use these personal and professional experiences, because it's all good material, even the stuff that's bad.
Yeah.
And you're going to surprise yourself when you step away from the constraints of the corporate world and run your own show.
Yeah.
And that's really what drove me.
Yeah.
That I'll never forget. Our regional manager at my last corporate job told all the salespeople throughout the whole state of Florida, I'm going to have a one-on-one conversation with you about your career path here at Mega Corporation of the World. Okay, fine. And we came
Sounds
my
like a
turn.
Scene in The Simpsons or something.
We're in the office. When it came to me, my turn, I said to him, well, I figure by such and such a date, I'm going to be out of here because there's no career path for me. He said, what? And I said, I'm not moving from Florida. My husband is a Floridian. And the corporate headquarters are not anywhere near Florida. I don't do what you guys want me to do. I'm reasonably successful, but not wildly successful. And I want to go, you know, if you guys are going north, northeast, 12 degrees, I'm going south, southwest by 40 degrees, and we just ain't going in the same direction.
You got to get off the bus before you go to the left.
Yeah, I think my stop is coming up. He could not believe I had the chutzpah to say that.
Oh.
And I thought, well, didn't you expect me to tell you the truth?
Yeah.
So you go figure it out.
Now, do you know what your personality profile is? DISC or Myers-Briggs?
Myers-Briggs, I'm an ENFJ.
Okay. Well, me and you are alike then. I am an ENFP, but I've kind of shifted to the ENFJ.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I can't take the test anymore because I'm so clear on my preferences. Always like 100% this and zero of that. But yeah, I think one of the reasons I'm having so much fun now is that I'm starting to work fewer hours. I'm actually consciously working about 3.5 days. For one thing, at my age, I really don't have the stamina to pull those long hours. But I need more time to do the thinking work. And that's why I'm starting, you know, I have a big marketing team. They're contractors, but they've just been wonderful. I'm going to be making our first actual hire. I have a number of consulting firms with whom I collaborate on a regular basis. So I'm filling in some of the stuff I want to get done, but don't know how to do.
Yeah.
Building capacity so that, you know, I can take the innovations I've been able to develop and leave them behind me when I'm either lose interest, which I doubt will happen, or lose my marbles.
Which will you lose first?
I think the marbles are
Well, I want to go back. You mentioned speaking up to that superior. Yeah. I imagine they're probably, obviously he was surprised. There might be a lot of people that are like, wow, I'm surprised that you did that. But there are a lot of people that might be feeling and thinking that inside of themselves. They want to do what you did, but they're afraid. So what would you tell that person?
You shouldn't be afraid to fail. The very first time I was asked to do a public speech, I said, I'll do it as long as you let me speak about the value of failure. And I did. I talked about, I thought at one point I was going to be a professional dancer as a career. Well, my knees and feet gave out on me before that turned into a reality. I went to art school. I discovered I was really interested in ceramic arts. And I discovered, you know, after you've thrown your 3,000th mug, it's not particularly interesting anymore. And yes, I appreciate that there are, we have to make a living, right? We have to be able to put a roof over our heads and feed our children and make sure that everybody is healthy and clothed and all of that sort of stuff. And I say this with humility because I know there are people who, lots of people, who don't have this luxury, but you are really worse off staying in a job for the so-called security when the job isn't good for you. It eats you from the inside out.
Yeah.
You know, and you're going to go home and kick the dog and be grouchy to the kids, and they're going to grow up and say, I don't ever want to be like that parent.
Yeah.
So, anyway, these days, what does security look like?
Yeah. Well, it's funny. Right? Well, it's funny you say that because so I freelance and I have multiple clients. And so if one of my clients decides to stop working with me, I've got a handful of others. So I might have like a 10%, you know, diminishment. Yeah. But my risk is diversified across multiple clients. But if someone has a job, their risk, they have one source of income. So if they lose that job, they lose all of it.
Well, not so long ago, well, relatively speaking, state of Florida provides a great deal of funding for early childhood education and family services.
Yeah.
And there was one fine day, a colleague of mine who, we never actually quite got to work together because just as she was about to sign a contract, she got an overnight message. Hey, we've been funding your organization to the tune of $200 million a year. We're cutting you back to $20 million. They had never successfully raised money from anyone except the government source. Mm-hmm. The state of Florida. And she had to lay off over 200 people the following.
Wow.
So yeah, when you can freelance, you can spread the risk.
Yeah.
Some months you'll be a little worse off and some months you'll be a little bit ahead. And listen to me, kids, if you can master the selling part.
Yes, yes.
You'll be fine.
I guess I kind of wonder if part of the mastering part, not wanting to master it, not wanting to do it. One of the challenges that freelancers can face and that they fall into is that very dynamic. They get one big client and then they're essentially working for that one client when they need to. And so one of the things I've done is I impose a limit. Like I don't let any one client work with me more than like a third of my total income to prevent that kind of dynamic. But I do wonder if the aversion to sales is part of why that dynamic ends up happening.
I have to say I think it is because I've seen this over and over and over. And so I've got about 50 years, give or take, business experience, which is one of the reasons I'm having such a good time being an old bag. You know, it's like we've got so much to look back on. And after a while, I say, no, I survived that. But the number of times I've heard people say, I'll do anything. I'll scrub floors. I'll wash the toilet. I'll do, you know, horrible stuff as long as I don't have to ask people for money. And I don't get it. You know, what's so awful? Some will say yes and some will say no. And the ones who say yes, you say, thank you very much. And you go on to the next one. The ones who say no, you say, thanks for listening to me. Sorry, we won't be able to work together. And you go on to the next one. I mean, yeah. Hello. I really wish I could sort of package this like candy and get people
hand them
get
out.
Over. Yeah. Cause
well, I think I can relate to that because I've learned stuff and I want to share that with someone, right? And
yeah.
But in some ways, I went on a journey to learn that thing, and a lot of people got to go on the journey too, you know?
That's the deal. I think when you asked me if I could look back at the 39-year-old me, I spent all these years in sales, and I was handicapped by sales reluctance and call reluctance and ask reluctance myself. And I got over it bit by bit because I changed the dynamic somehow.
Yeah.
I still knew I wanted to transfer my goods and services to them and have them transfer their money to me. Okay.
Yeah.
And I just had to interrupt the pattern of what the popular conception of selling or fundraising was.
Yeah.
And one of the things that we have historically done with our clients is we get them to go out and ask these open-ended questions of their best buyers and their best donors. And they don't ask them for money.
Yeah.
They explicitly say, the instructions are, you're not asking for money. You're asking questions to build an ideal donor profile. Okay? That's it. So you're going to ask these simple questions. And you're going to say, if you could spare me 20 minutes or 30 minutes. And invariably, clients come back and say, wow, I can ask those questions all day long. Because guess what happens? They talk, the client then or the donor says, wait a minute, this is really making sense. Could I be involved? Could I make an investment? Could I, you know, buy your teddy bears, whatever.
Yeah.
So.
Well, I guess one other quick question I'd like to throw at you before I ask you some of the other questions we've talked about. You've had all this history. You mentioned the 2008 economic crisis, and you've obviously experienced multiple economic crises.
Yeah. So when I hear there's another inflationary period or a recession of this, I'm like, oh boy.
Well, and that's what I'm curious. Like when you hear about like the state of our country, the world, the economic ups and downs, because of how much experience you have in history, how do you see those things when they come up? Does it seem like it's getting worse, or does it just seem like, oh, the cycle is just restarting?
It's just weird because it's a little bit of both.
Yeah.
The reason I think it's genuinely worse now is because of the climate crisis.
Okay.
You know, I listened to the news about national politics here in the U.S. And then I listened to the news about Russia and the Ukraine and the Sudan and, you know, pick your local warfare. And I kind of want to shake the TV or the announcer and say, why are we wasting our time on this? Life is scarce and precious in the universe. We really don't know if there's other sentient life in the universe. And we're wasting our time messing around with these little foolishness things when we could be working to repair the climate and make sure that people have enough to eat and clean water to drink. So I think the reality of climate crisis makes whatever is going on right now far more grave.
So I think, I guess what I'm hearing from you there is you're looking at this particular issue, and it's a big issue. So it kind of gives you a perspective on other things to contextualize it. Right. And then
that's
maybe.
Exactly right.
Okay. Yeah. And yeah, so. Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah. I'm sure we could talk about that a lot, but I do want to keep moving along. Well, you talked about joy. So I want to ask you what it means to live better. Like, what does it mean to live with joy?
It's silly and funny little things.
Yeah.
It's feeling well when you haven't been feeling well. I mean, mm-hmm. physically.
Yeah.
It's having a partner in your life who you can poke with your elbow, and that's the whole communication that you need. It's very hard for me to put this in words, but it's like, look, I've really been granted a gift. I'm still alive, healthy, and having fun at my age. And I think I have many more years, or as many as I want to, kind of. Because I'm seeing that so much is enjoyable.
Yeah.
You know, I'm sitting here and looking out the window. There's a blue jay on the railing out there. Okay, it's not a rare bird. It's a blue jay, you know, and the wind is.
Yeah. Like appreciating all the things that you took for granted. Is that maybe a
way to say it? Yeah, that's what I'm trying to say. Eating a simple meal.
Yeah, that tastes good.
Throwing myself in the swimming pool when it's not 120 degrees outside. Knowing that there are people I love who love me back.
Yeah.
Knowing that I have all these wonderful professional colleagues who I can, including clients, who I can laugh with. That's like, if I could list my corporate values, that would be way up there at the top.
Yeah.
Are we enjoying this? Are we enjoying each other? Are we making new discoveries that make things even more interesting?
Yeah. Yeah, that's interesting. How does someone move towards that if they're in the opposite, if they're in kind of cynicism and nihilism?
Don't I wish I had the answer to that? I'll say what I said before, and it's really hard to do this. I've experienced really severe episodes of clinical depression. And I know there are times when you feel there is absolutely no way out. But get help, you know, reach out for something. I really think over the years, I was for a lot of years, I was too stupid and too stubborn to give up, even at the worst. I kind of always believed I could live through no matter how bad it was. And the more I lived through it, maybe sometimes it was just a little bit better, but I'd wake up still alive the next day, you know? So my heart goes out to people who are cynical and nihilistic because they're costing themselves the pleasure of simply being alive.
Yeah. Let's shift gears to the work side of it. So like
Sure.
me, you are a recovering workaholic. So
Right.
what does it look like to work smarter? And do you get more done in 3.5 days than when you were working a million hours a week?
Well, for one thing, I don't have to get up real early in the morning. It's great. Well, I think one of the things that started to help me reach this state that I'm in now was really peeling off more time for myself to rest. It's been a struggle for so long, but I was always working so hard, much harder than I ever needed to, when I was working in corporate and since I started my own business, to the point where I was sick all the time. I always had a sinus infection or, you know, upper respiratory infection. I had a cold or I twisted my ankle or something was always messing me up. And I'm calmer. I'm less excitable. And I get a lot more done when I get a lot of rest. I think I actually need more rest than a lot of people might. You know, I know people who can do just fine on a diet of 4 hours of sleep a night. Wish I could.
Well, but I bet you they're going to pay the consequences for that over time.
At some point.
Yeah.
Yeah. So rest is really important. Taking care of yourself is really important.
Well, it's interesting because you mentioned the climate. And the way that I think about it is how do we live sustainably?
Yeah.
And with our environments. And I think that's what you're talking about is how do you work sustainably, right? It's if you're going to go at this another 10 years, how do you do it in a sustainable way so that it's life-giving instead of life-depleting, right?
Yeah, that's a great way to put it.
So if we're doing something that's not sustainable for a short period of time, like it's defined and we do that and we move on, but to, right. to do that, make that permanent, which I think is kind of the American way. It's like, how do I live unsustainably? And then burn right. myself out. And then I'm going to pay like interest on that time I recover. Right.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And you really will build up an enormous debt you can no longer repay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And, that's
and some people, it's so much, it's so severe that it, yeah. Debt. Yeah, exactly. Or, so, or the way we die was, is horrible. You know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I don't have a magic solution. I can just say, if at all possible, if you don't have to work three crappy jobs to pay the rent and put food on the table, try not to. You have to experiment sometimes. You have to take risks. Mm-hmm. Sometimes buy a harmonica, play music. I don't know. I don't want to get into the hokey ideas, but really the question really is, how do you sustain a life that has more joy and less? Joy includes tragedy, you know?
Yeah.
You're going to lose people, right? But it doesn't have to include cynicism and fury and chronic anger. Those are the things that'll really kill you.
Yeah. I think in a lot of ways, I read this book recently called The Grieving Brain, about the neuroscience of how we grieve. And when I was reading it, one of the thoughts I had is, wow, our country, the people in our country have a lot of grieving that they have not dealt with yet. That's how it felt because the symptoms were similar. So I'm curious what you think about grieving and how does that play a role here? Particularly, you know, you have those ups and downs in business. When I shut down my company, Noodlehead Marketing, 2014, it felt like a death. Like I did grieve it. It was rough. So I don't know. What do you think?
Well, when I was expecting to be laid off from my last corporate job, I did not sleep all night, and I knew that I had gotten a message over the weekend, show up early. So-and-so from HR will be there. So I knew that was it, right? And I actually kept asking myself, will I physically survive? If I don't have a job, will my body continue to exist? And, you know, it's like, no, don't be an idiot, you know? But that's how I felt. And even though I was so glad to be done with that job, I grieved losing it. I didn't know what to do with myself. So for me, part of the grief was something that's part of the Jewish tradition, which is sitting Shiva.
Okay.
You cover all the mirrors in your house, sit on a low stool, and people come, and you don't do anything. The mirrors and all the other baloney is the, you know, if you're really deeply into ritual observance. But the point is, you take 7 or 8 days to do nothing,
yeah,
except grieve. And I think it's a really healthy approach.
Yeah.
And I was so worn out. I took what I refer to as a 6-week nap.
Yeah.
You know? So, I think oftentimes when I hear some of the more egregious harms that have been done in our society in recent years, you did that because you were angry. You did that because you aren't angry like because you don't like people whose skin is a different color. You did it because you feel cheated inside somehow.
Okay.
And it's like you didn't grieve something. I can't tell you what it is, but anger is a great way to shield yourself from real grief. Why not get angry? That makes you feel like you can do something. You can go break a window, you know, or kick the dog.
I think that sense of helplessness is a part of it.
Yeah. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense to me. And I think that might be part of what's been making me so increasingly happy the older I get, is that it's becoming more clear to me how much agency I have.
Tell me more about that.
Well, I always, you know, as a recovering workaholic, I always used to think nothing could get done unless I did it. So my books were always a mess, you know, more like accounting, because I suck at that sort of thing. I always knew what my marketing should look like, but I didn't have the confidence to outsource it or hire somebody to do it. And then I'd be grouchy and crabby and feeling sorry for myself. And instead of saying, do the best you can with what you have, you don't have the money. Or instead of saying, why don't I take a risk and get somebody to do that stuff for me? And the more I let go, the more competent I became. I'm really good at some things. I'm not very good at other things. Don't ask me to play the trombone, you know? I don't have to, there are things you don't have to do all by yourself. You know, almost always get somebody to help you.
But that's the American way, is doing it yourself,
work yourself,
right?
So, to death.
So how do you encourage people to embrace community when we're so autonomous?
It's really interesting. I think that's one reason I fell in love with the nonprofit sector.
Mm.
They're infected with the same thing, but they're so mission driven. You know, they tend to be caught up in something that's greater than themselves.
Yeah.
And you know, it's just a nice place to be, because they listen, there are jerks everywhere you want to go. All right, I don't mean to turn everybody in the nonprofit sector into some sort of saint, but I really like the fact that there's, you know, something like 10% of the U.S. workforce works for a nonprofit. This is an enormous industry.
Yeah.
And their jobs are to improve life or health or social conditions or justice or communities or fill in the blank.
Yeah.
And it's one of the reasons I love working in this sector.
Yeah. So on that note, like mentoring, what's its importance? I mean, you talked about legacy and kind of leaving behind something, and I think that ties into it. It's like you want to give something. So tell us, you know, how does mentoring factor into your life?
Boom. You know, it plays an increasingly large role. I don't have children of my own. I have a stepson who is now 51.
Yeah.
And I have grandchildren who there's mutual adoration, but they're just about to graduate from high school and they don't want to spend all their time with grandma and grandpa. You know?
Yeah.
And I gravitate to working with younger people. You know, I also gravitate to working with older people, but I have a lot of the people I work with are younger than I am,
yeah,
anywhere from 10 to 40 years younger. And it's a treat because it's always a two-way exchange. But, you know, let's give it away.
Yeah. Yeah. What are some real and or fictional stories, narratives that have shaped you as a person?
I was a major Dickens fan.
Okay.
I read everything Charles Dickens ever wrote. And
wow.
I read every novel. Like, I'd start at the beginning of every... There was a period of time where I read everything he wrote every year from beginning to end. And in later years, I've started to read more about his actual life, which did not emerge quite so clearly. But his favorite novel was one he wrote late in his life, David Copperfield. And it's my favorite novel, too. And I think the reason it's my favorite is that the boy David Copperfield starts out in life with every conceivable disadvantage. Mm. And he discovers all kinds of surprising and delighting and tragic steps along the path to a happy, mature life.
Yeah.
It's very, very touching. I also have to say...
Well, and it ties into what you said about agency. Like, despite all the things going against someone, we still have a choice to move forward and to move through it and how we move through it.
That's right.
Yeah.
Another thing that had a huge impact on my life was that I started to take piano lessons when I was about 6.
Okay.
So I always took piano lessons, you know, what you do. And we moved to a new town when I was in middle school, and my parents found me a new piano teacher. And he and his wife had just graduated from Juilliard. Now, they're both from Louisiana. Juilliard, what do I need to say? Their career choice was to move to a suburban town and teach piano lessons to kids with Juilliard degrees. What? And from the very first day, I owe so much to Noel Tipton. I don't know if he's still alive. The last time I spoke to him, he was already in his late 80s. He treated me like an adult, by which I mean he introduced me to challenging professional piano literature, and he held me to very high standards. And he was as kind and respectful as you could ever imagine. But he never let me off the hook. Play those scales again. Your timing's off. Your fingering's off. Whatever. And there was something about, I worked with him for 6 or 7 years. He did something for me that released my sense of agency and also held me accountable to high standards. And it was such a gift to an insecure girl.
Yeah.
To be treated with so much respect and with such high expectations.
Well, it sounds like, it might sound counterintuitive, but the word that comes to my mind to describe that is freedom.
That was it. It was when I could not wait for my next lesson, because I was freed of all of the whatever kooky stuff was going on. I wasn't a popular kid in high school. I never had a date. My parents were messed up. My brother was, besides being the prince of the family, was also desperately ill. And it was, you know, life was kind of a mess. And I'd walk in there and all of a sudden, all of that just flew away. Mm. It's like, let's play the Bartok piece again. Play it again with feeling.
Yeah.
You know? And it was so freeing. I just can't say enough about that experience.
Yeah. Now, so there's narratives, and those are ways that we make sense of the world, but there's also systems that help us navigate through it. And you're a big systems person.
So talk about systems for us. Okay, cool. I think one of the reasons I fell in love with systems was because they were so clean and clear. And you could leave all the monkey voices in your head shelf when you sat down to work on a system.
Yeah.
Right? Just take all that stuff out of your brain, park it over there. You can pick it up on the way out. But leave it over there. So I created the first leaky bucket assessment because I had this brilliant idea back in about 2009. That if you had something interactive on your website, you'd get more traffic. And then I realized I had written a survey that nobody else in the nonprofit sector had done, because it was all about internal disciplines, not about tactics. How do you start a conversation with a donor? How do you make the ask? How do you write a grant? It was none of that. It was like, do you have an ideal? You know, how do you know how to qualify somebody? In other words, do you have an ideal donor profile? And do you have dopey stuff like, do you keep track of key performance indicators to make life simple about amount of retained donors and acquired donors and upgraded donors? And these are just 9 statements in about less than a year.
Sorry, my alarm. It's time to wind it down today.
Okay. So pretty quickly, we got assessments for from every continent on the planet, including Antarctica. And we just released, or in the process of releasing, Leaky Bucket Pro, which is way upgraded continuous improvement engine that uses business intelligence and data visualization. And I'm so excited about it. My brain's blown. So we're running out of time, right?
No. That was my alarm for every day. It goes off at 5:30 just to start to decompress the day so I can go back home with the family. But we still have time, so we're good.
So yeah, the Leaky Bucket Pro is really cool because, having started out in the world of technology, I've always kept up with it, and I was sort of an early adopter.
So it never scared you, all these innovations over the decades?
No. Yeah. I'm at the point now where I'm finding it a little bit more difficult to keep up with. The pace of change has really...
Yeah. The changes are happening more often.
Yeah. And I just can't learn new systems as fast as I used to. The Leaky Bucket Pro is super cool. You get everybody in your organization, the entire governing board, the entire development team, senior leadership, the finance people. You can even have program people in, because God forbid, fundraising has to pay their salaries and enable them to deliver their goods and programs. And what we're already finding out, which we knew from the free version, was a discrepancy between what the senior leadership and the governing board think is going on in fundraising is very different from what's really going on.
Yeah, the illusion versus reality.
Oh, yeah. And it's funny because a lot of times the board thinks what's going on is much worse than what's really going on. And in other areas, they overestimate the capacity and competency of their fundraising team. It's like,
yeah,
wait a minute, folks, something's wrong.
Yeah. Why are they avoiding that truth?
I think it goes back to this tradition that money is icky poo poo, filthy lucre. Don't talk about it. It's disgusting. You're supposed to be doing this because of the goodness of your heart.
Okay.
Yeah, right. The other thing is people have gotten into really bad habits. So if you've ever sat on a governing board, you may know that once a month or once a quarter or once every 2 months, whenever it is that the board meets, you get a financial report. But it's usually looking over your shoulder at the past, right? It's your balance sheet and your profit and loss statement. Nobody does a forecast in the nonprofit sector, which blows my mind. Doesn't the board want to know?
Well, and it seems like if you know all the people that are giving regularly, you have that, and then you can see what's the gap between what we need and that.
And do we have any money stuck under the mattress in case there's an opportunity to innovate, right?
Yeah, that's great. So,
one of the things that we'll be recommending is, look, if you don't have an ideal donor profile, you need to have one. If you don't have KPIs, you need to establish them. If you can't track progress, you need to figure out how to track progress of major giving opportunities. But guys, clean up your reporting.
Yeah, visibility, right?
Duh. That's what makes data so cool to me. You can make sense out of it. Where you can't make sense out of the following kind of report. Well, Jason, Mr. Board Chair, we think we got this grant, but we don't really know if we got it. And such donor said that they talked to us about giving us another gift after they get back from their trip around the world, and I'm not quite sure when that is. And that other donor can't do anything because his mother-in-law's brother-in-law's dog catcher's manicurist is in the hospital. And, you know, can you make sense out of that? I can't. But if I look at a table or a spreadsheet or, God forbid, a graph, which is easy to understand, then I know what's happening.
Yeah. So it sounds like you're Moses, and these are the Israelites that you're helping to bring out of Egypt.
Yes. Where is my staff?
Taking them to the promised land. There's a better way.
This makes me think about the 2,000-year-old man, right? These 15, whoops. No, I mean 10 commandments. Oh, man. Well, yeah, we're also releasing a pipeline tracker that simplifies the tracking of large investments. So, because you know, everybody buys CRMs, but
what do they do with them?
People hate to update them. So, we figured out a way to make it simpler.
Yeah.
So I'm having a blast. I gotta tell you.
Now, so you've built these systems in Leaky Bucket and stuff like that. Do you, is there a Ellen system for your personal life? Does it translate, or is it only in the business that you think about systems?
I formalized it much more in the business.
Yeah.
But I really have to say, I never thought about it much, but I'm getting much better at using systems thinking in my private life, especially around taking care of myself. And making time for the people I love and even the people I'll just plain like.
Yeah.
And there are still things I am really terrible at doing.
Well, that's the nice thing about systems, is it gives you superpower to do something you're terrible at, right?
right, exactly.
So I'm going to ask you about your parting words of wisdom. But before I do that, I think you need to tell us about what's going on with the elephants behind you.
Oh, don't you love my elephant? You know, a friend of mine had spent some years in Nepal. She's a big fan of Nepalese culture.
Okay.
She was moving. And I happened to drop by when she was packing up all her stuff. And she said, Ellen, would you like this? It's a batik.
Okay, what does that mean?
Batik is it's a way of dyeing silk.
Okay.
That, think of tie dyeing. Okay. But instead of tying stuff, what you do is paint your silk with wax.
Okay.
And carve out the wax and then dye it. And then carve out some more of the wax dye it.
Yeah.
And eventually I've got a little herd of Asian elephants behind me sitting next to my lucky bamboo.
Wow. Now, did they go together or are they unrelated?
No, they didn't. But one of my new systems is, hey, Ellen, why don't you do some indoor gardening?
Yeah.
A house filled with plants. And I was at this wonderful nursery near us that only sells bamboos and orchids.
Yeah. Okay?
And they had this giant pot of lucky bamboo, and you can't see it from here, but it's in a ceramic container. And the front of it is a little Asian elephant with his trunk raised and his little feeties.
So here's the thing. I need you to send me a picture of you riding an elephant now.
I'll have to go down to the zoo.
Yeah, you better go down. If you don't have that picture already, you're going to have to do it.
That's all right. So funny.
What final words of wisdom do you have for us? Is there anything you want to share that you didn't get a chance to share?
Oh, I'm going to quote from way back. A character from R. Crumb, Mr. Natural, a cartoonist, alternative cartoonist from the 60s and 70s, said, always use the right tool for the job. And these days, we are so fortunate to have all of these technology tools that can make our lives easier and better.
Yeah.
And the other thing I want to say is take a nap, everybody. Take a day off, get home early, get in late once in a while. Think about how much of what you're overdoing you really don't need to overdo.
Yeah.
I know that's not easy for people making low incomes and living in underserved areas, but your life is so precious. You have to enjoy it.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you for sharing. What are you up to? How can people connect you? Where are you at online?
I'm online everywhere. Bristol Strategy Group. So it's Ellen at BristolStrategyGroup.com. It's also Ellen at BristolAnalytics.com. Okay. We have Facebook and LinkedIn for both brands. And okay. I'm personally
and
on
help
Facebook.
Us understand, what's the difference between the Bristol Analytics and the Bristol
Bristol
Strategy?
Analytics is the product brand. That's where we're putting all our Power BI tools, surveys, assessments, and calculators. Bristol Strategy Group is the parent company where we'll continue to do our consulting work.
Okay. And then you're active on Facebook and LinkedIn? Mm-hmm. All right. And are you on TikTok or Instagram?
Instagram, yeah. TikTok, no, it's too much like work.
And then you gave us your emails. Now, you're also an author. The last time I checked, you still an author?
Yeah.
Those books still on Amazon or somewhere else?
Fundraising the Smart Way is still on Amazon. The Leaky Bucket, What's Wrong with Your Fundraising, How You Can Fix It, is, I think, out of print. But we published a new book during the pandemic called Success Planning. Okay. Success Planning for Nonprofits, Evidence-Based Strategic Planning.
Okay. And is that on Amazon as well or on your website?
That's on Amazon.
Okay, right.
What looks on Amazon.
Okay. And then who is a good fit to work with you if they want to work with your consulting team?
Good fits for us are companies, we've been doing a lot of this work, businesses that are already relatively mature, but they're lagging in their individual giving programs. Maybe doing decent work funded by government contracts and foundation grants, but they don't know how to get a philanthropy program going very well. And we're also doing something that seems off-brand in a way. I'm collaborating with a couple of other people to do a cohort training for startups and emerging nonprofits and small organizations that may have been around for a long time but have no real fundraising staff. It's all volunteers. So we were approached by a foundation that is funding us to do a six-month program that does everything from board development through fundraising strategy and management through fundraising tactics.
Okay. Cool.
And that's going to be called the Level Up Nonprofit Accelerator.
Okay.
Luna.
And is that something coming to a theater near you or is that later next year?
Yeah, we'll have that launched by the end of September.
Okay. Wow. Okay, great. Cool. Anything else you want to talk about or promote as far as your business goes?
Don't call me. text me. I always love to talk to people, honestly. I'm always happy to talk to almost anybody that we can fit in.
Yeah. And you've got a blog, you set the blog up with articles and stuff and the newsletter.
Newsletter, but we're publishing more and more blogs, posts, and we're going to start publishing what are called carousels.
Okay.
On LinkedIn, there where you have like a topic and it comes up in three little images, and each little image has a headline and a link to something.
Cool. So, okay. Yeah, that's
the first one. Going to be three simple questions that get donors to give.
Oh, cool. Yeah, so real practical advice if they follow you on LinkedIn.
Right.
Well, thank you so much for sharing your life with us today.
Oh, this was a blast. I've always enjoyed talking to you, Jason. I think you're
cool. Well, I appreciate it. Yeah, thank you. Thank you for listening to this episode of Share Life. For additional stories and systems to live better and work smarter, visit jasonscottmontoya.com. That's jasonscottmontoya.com. We look forward to having you listen in on the next episode of Share Life.